I guess, you know, as we mentioned, is it possible that local boys can make good? You know, these guys were just right on the cusp of an incredible success, and they decided to go their own ways.
Well, I think that a great band can make it from any place. I think that out of the Cleveland area, it's been proven over the years, and also in various other cities around it. It all depends how good the band is and how bad they want it.
Now, obviously, I think a lot of times people don't expect bands to come from heavy industrialized areas and do a sort of melodic type, I hate to say spiritual music, but I think you know what I mean, that type of music coming from these heavy industrialized cities. But the Harp really did it. They came forth with like a powerhouse there.
Well, I think it was because at the time, Phil and John and Dan were listening to a great variety of different kind of music, from the Beatles to Bad Company. And I think a lot of the melodic things just happened because they were so diverse into various kinds of music. And, of course, Phil was interested in classical music and jazz, as were the other two members of the band.
What do you think, as far as, you know, when you first heard this band, what were your initial impressions? I mean, obviously, you probably saw Diamond in the Rough, but what were your initial impressions of this band?
Well, I had gone to see the band because I was working with a young drummer who's gone on to some fame in the rock music business, a drummer by the name of Joe Vitale, and I was trying to find a guitar player for him, and I went to see the band up at JB's in Kent because somebody had told me about this young 16-year-old guitar player, and I walked in, I watched them for about 25 minutes, their set ended, I realized that they didn't need Joe Vitale in this band because the three members just sort of meshed like you have to in a great band, and I walked up and I said, "Hi, I'm Chip Killinger. I've been involved in the music business. I really like your band. And tell me, does anything scare you at all about the music business?" And they said to me, "Yeah, the only thing that scares us is when we have to play at the Royal Albert Hall in England and the Beatles are in the first row." And I said, "Boy, these guys want to make it."
What about... How do you go about promoting a band like that where you know they've got it? Do you look at strengths, weaknesses? How did you go about promoting this particular band?
Well, this band was such a unique, tight three-piece unit. I didn't try to do anything at all with their music or their stage appearance or anything. I just sort of let them be them. And they were playing a small club in Kent, Ohio, JB's, and they were writing their first album live on stage, basically. They were playing there like three nights a week, and I just let them go. And they just started coming up with great tunes and great music, and so I just started to promote them in the Cleveland, Akron area. And I was working for Warner Brothers Records at the time, so I knew a lot of people in the radio business, etc. And I just hyped the band, because they were that good.
Yeah, you know, you look at a band that comes up through the club circuit, signed to a major label like Decca, all of a sudden they're playing places like Fillmore, Carnegie Hall. Tell us a little bit about the Fillmore shows, Carnegie Hall. What do you remember about those?
Well, it was pretty fast and hectic back in the days. We played at the Fillmore East on their final concerts. They had a 2-week final concert thing. We played with Alice Cooper and Blood Rock, which was a weird pairing. I felt sorry for Blood Rock because the Harp came on first and did all this great music and great melodic stuff with a lot of hard stuff in it. And then out came Alice Cooper and threw his feathers around and stuff like that. And then afterwards, Blood Rock came out and they just didn't have any place to go, really. And it was jam-packed. We played there two nights in a row, and it was great. Carnegie Hall, we opened up for the Kinks. And it was just a magical night just to play in Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, did you give any advice about playing the big halls and playing the places like Carnegie Hall?
Nope. They knew how to do it. They were a great band. There was no advice you had to give them. They just knew instinctively what to do.
Now, obviously, you know, the three of them had a lot of faith, and Phil, of course, was, you know, as far as faith in God. Did you ever advise them, look, this could help you, this might not help you?
And what I don't quite understand.
A lot of times, I think back then a lot of people were saying, "Oh boy, Jesus Rock, I'm not going to listen to that." Still, they seem to transcend that. They, you know, people listen to them despite the message. A lot of times, people didn't want to hear that kind of message. This was a different era. This is the era of drugs, the generation gap, things like that. A lot of people didn't look at religion in rock. And in maybe some ways they were pioneers in that respect. Did you look at that and say, well, this could help them, this couldn't help, you know, this might not help them? I mean, you didn't tell them to tone it down. I mean, did you think this is going to limit them in any way?
Well, you know, you had to look at both sides of it. Maybe if somebody had to come and said, you got to tone this down, you got to stop this. I didn't look at it that way. I just felt it was great music, and the message certainly wasn't negative at all.
You know, I think that's a big part of it. If it's not a negative message,
right.
You know, because a lot of people, when, you know, the message is negative, it just turns them right off. And you look at a lot of the weird groups from the 70s who were popular for a while, and then you see that their core audience was a negative audience in many ways.
Right.
And without mentioning a lot of names and stuff. Tell us about K-San out in San Francisco. That was a famous show, and I think Mike Bloomfield was supposed to be there.
Yes, we played on, we did like the first hour live from K-San Studio. Tom Donahue, one of the fathers of FM radio, the other ones being in Cleveland, Ohio, was there. He put these live shows on the air, and we played for the first hour, and then Mike Bloomfield played for the second hour. And there was probably about 150, 200 of the FM-type people in San Francisco in attendance, and it was a great afternoon.
You know, as you look at guiding a band like this, obviously they came to a point where they wanted to go different directions. What were your thoughts about it when they were right at the edge of becoming this major national group? They were already a national group, but I mean, to a different plane, a different strata. What was your advice? What happened when you heard that they were going to do that?
I cried. I mean, it was something that was not because of just circumstances. It wasn't something that was going to happen. And to me, it was a sad day.
It was a sad day, obviously.
Now, we've had a few reunions and stuff, and they've been great, and everybody's still the greatest of friends. And it's really funny, if you look at everybody's life after that, everybody's still here, they're still kicking, and doing reasonably well. Everybody who's involved is still in the music business. I'm talking about the roadies, the sound guys, myself, my other partner, Bill Abel, who was involved in the group, and Dan and John and Phil are all still, you know, involved in the business.
You know, how do you explain to a young group, and obviously they wanted to make it, you need fire. You've got to do this and this and this. You're going to have to push and push and push to get ahead. I'll do my part, but I need your cooperation. I need your help. And, I mean, did you really have to instill that kind of fire in them?
Well, see, there was a particular point after their first album when everybody was sort of in their minds going different ways. I tried to instill some things, such as, let's write some tunes before we get to New York to make the second album. And they were sort of, oh, don't worry about it. Well, I learned my lesson. I was young then, too, and I'm never going back to New York with a band that isn't ready for an album.
Yeah, right. That can happen.
But, hey, they were going in different directions, and it was not. I could talk to them, but they were, you got to remember, they were like 16, 17, and 20 years old. And they don't think like a 35-year-old.
You know, that's another question I came up with. Does youth play, how much of a role does youth play in this, where obviously there's a certain naivete about the music business, but, and you were already, you know, well entrenched in it. What kind of problem is that for a young band? How does youth play against them, work against them?
Well, they don't know the second half of the two-word thing of what this is. This is the music business. And the people on the business side have certain ways they do things. And when you're real youthful, you don't realize that, and it sort of slows you down at times. Although youth does have its good aspects, such as spontaneity and, you know, youthful drive, youthful hormones, whatever you want to say.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, just to wrap it up in a short one, let's talk a little bit about what happened to this band after they split. Obviously, they did pretty well. And I mean, like, you know, all of them joined, you know, other, went in various musical directions. They're all still playing. You've obviously watched them over the years.
Yes.
Now, you know, what do you see different about them now? I mean, obviously, you grow in the music business. There's a maturity. What do you see about that? Well, you know, is there anything you can tell us about since they've left, what are some things you've observed about them?
No, I think their personalities are pretty much the same. I mean, they've changed over the years and grown up, but basically I think if you get them all three in the same room together, they'd be the same guys that the only thing that was going to ever bother them in the music business is when they played it in England in front of the Beatles.
Sure. What about the another thing, that maybe just to wrap things up here, is you look back on an era that's a wonderful era, not only for Northeast Ohio, but, you know, sort of the music industry, and certainly for these guys in this band and yourself. What do you think we should keep in mind about that era? What do you think we should keep in mind about the band and that whole part of everyone's lives?
Well, I think that we should remember what the music was saying back in those days, and don't give up on our hopes and dreams, and try to get the world to be in a better place. And I think that the Glass Harp was trying to say that in many ways.
I think it's a good quote to end not only the interview, but